Charlie Rosen is a basketball man, or at least he has been. Toward the end of his new book, Crazy Basketball, he writes, quote, "Nowadays, I only touch a basketball once every year, so maybe he's best characterized as a recovering basketball man. But he was a college player, and for years he coached under some seriously bizarre circumstances in the now-defunct Continental Basketball Association. The stories from those days and others fill Crazy Basketball, and Charlie Rosen joins me now from WAMC in Albany, New York, to tell some of them. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Happy to be back.
Some of the memories from your early basketball days involve the players from the Eastern League, many of whom had been involved in college basketball's betting scandals back in the 50s. You write that as a young man, you were, and I'm quoting now, stunned by the total lack of joy with which they played. Was this because basketball was all about joy for you?
When I was 18 years old, it was. And then to encounter these guys who were so good, down to the tiniest nuance, and they just played without smiles. It was stunning, as you mentioned, but it was also very sad and very puzzling.
One story from your Eastern League days involves a player named Dick Gaines of the Scranton Miners, whom you describe, and I'm quoting again, as a marginal criminal type. At least once, Mr. Gaines convinced an opponent named George Blaney to refrain from having a second great game against the Miners. How did he do that?
He threatened him with a gun. And he indeed did have a gun. I saw it in his bag. And I had known Blaney. I had played against him a couple of times during the summer. And he came over to me after the first game, in which Blaney played very well against Gaines. I said, "Hey, Charlie, this guy threatened me with a gun. What should I do?" I said, "If I were you, I'd step on the brakes, because he has a gun. Indeed, he does, and who knows what he will do." And that scared George enough to impair his play in the second game.
He shot something like 2 for 19 in the second game.
Right.
You worked as an assistant coach under Phil Jackson in the Continental Basketball Association, and there you found that it's fairly common for CBA players to simply vanish, or so you wrote. Can you give me an example or two?
Well, there was one player when I coached in Albany, the Albany Patroons. He had a habit of vanishing. What he would do is borrow money from people while he was on the team and then disappear, and totally disappear for like a year. And I eventually hooked up with this guy who had played in the NBA for a little bit and made a trade for him, and he was a great player. We went on a winning streak, and I thought we really had a chance to win a championship. And then one day he didn't show up to practice. Nobody knew where he had gone to, and I haven't heard from him since.
Eventually, you became a head coach in the CBA. You ran the Patroons for a time, and then the Rockford Lightning, the Oklahoma City Cavalry, and the Savannah Spirits. But you were told by the owner of the Spirits that you weren't, quote, sufficiently heartless to succeed in the coaching business. What led him to that conclusion?
Well, he was in Detroit. He was centered in Detroit, and he had someone drive him, actually, to Savannah just to check up on the organization and really to supply a transfusion to the front office. They were running out of money fast, and he brought a player with him. And I forgot his name, but the player he brought was a great defensive player, incredible defensive player. But he had kind of a mean-eyed, inner-city look about him. And to put him on the team, I would have had to cut a young man who had played at the Citadel, and I really liked. He was just a nice fellow. He played pretty good defense. He had an on-and-off jump shot. Reagan Truesdale was his name, and he was yes, sir, and yes, sir. And he just helped the chemistry of the team so much that I couldn't bear it. Even though the guy brought from Detroit was a better player, I just didn't have the heart to send this guy home and just add another guy on the team who may have disrupted that chemistry. So I refused, and that's when the owner told me that I didn't have what it took to make it. He was right.
Well, you held on for a number of years despite
that,
though.
Yeah, well, there was nothing else I could figure out to do.
There were a lot of frustrating nights in the CBA, but only one of them landed you in jail. How did that happen?
Oh, yeah, I knew you'd bring that up. Well, it's a long story, but the short version, Eric Musselman was coaching. He later coached in the NBA. He called me up. He said he had just played a game in Cedar Rapids, and the coach there put a full-court trap on with like a minute left to go, and his team ahead by 20 points. Would I speak to him about it? So I did. He said, no, I don't do that. I never do anything like that. He's wrong. Okay, so we play the game. We're competitive for the first three quarters. We get blown out in the fourth quarter, which irritated me anyway. And the same thing happened. He's up about 15, 20 points with a minute left to go. And he calls out red, and he put a full court press on. So I got up and screamed down at him, what are you doing? And he cursed me and said, if you don't like it, come on down here and do something about it. So I did. I went down there and tried to get at him, but one of the referees grabbed me and pulled me away. Of course, I was thrown out of the game. So I'm in the locker room fuming at the owner, at the game, at the other coach. I had a lot of things to be mad about. And I decided to go out into the hallway to get a drink. And the game happened to be over, and there was the other coach preening in front of the media, saying what a hothead I was and blah, 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 and I should stick to writing poetry, of all things. So I ran at him and took a couple of wild swings, which didn't connect. The cop appeared out of nowhere, threw me to the ground, put his knee on my chest, and my players surrounded him at the time. Like, hey, you know, leave him alone, leave him alone. And this little white cop kind of looked up and saw these, you know, 6'9", 6'10", black guys circling him, and he reached for his gun. So that set me off again. You know, who are you going to shoot? How many bullets you have? You going to shoot all of us? So he kind of let us go, went into the locker room. 10 minutes later, a riot squad came, pulled me out, threw me up against the wall, beat me with their batons in my legs, took me to jail, booked me, and I spent about 3 hours there. My players pooled their money to bail me out. They had a meal waiting for me, and they all told me about the times that they were in jail and were very happy that I had stood up for them.
You write that in the CBA, anybody could be traded for anything. Keeping in mind that this is a family show, tell us a little more about some of the league's stranger trades.
Well, one player was traded for a sex act to be performed later.
Well, that was nicely done. I think that's okay,
even on
a family show. Good for you.
One trade happened because a team in Wyoming had this halftime stunt where they brought a car out to center court, opened the sunroof. You could make a paper airplane out of the program, come to half court, and throw the paper airplane. If it landed in the car, you won the car. The dealer who supplied the car said it was impossible to do. They monkeyed around with the fans in the arena to discourage that, but one guy succeeded, and they had to give him the car. And it cost the franchise, the Wyoming Wildcatters in Casper, Wyoming, it cost them $6,000, which they didn't have. So they traded their best player to me for $6,000. So basically a paper airplane was the impetus for that particular trade.
At least once, if I read this book properly, it seems to me that you traded a player in order to get rid of that player's wife. Have I got that right?
Oh, yeah. I won't mention his name, but he played in the Big Ten, and he broke a finger in training camp. And he did nothing to stay in shape. He didn't run laps. He didn't even come to practice. And when the season started, he was ready to play. But I didn't play him, and he had been a starter the year before when someone else coached the team. So I just thought I'd kind of feed him in and play him 4 minutes or 5 minutes until he got into the swing of things. And after the very first game when he didn't start and only played a couple of minutes, his wife just jumped me after the game and started screaming curses at me. And how could I do this? So I just got on the phone and immediately traded him.
It must be nice to have that kind of power.
Well, yeah, you know, that's the one advantage that the CBA had over the NBA. The NBA, you have to worry about no-cut contracts and equitable salaries. And college, you can't trade anybody. So the CBA was really, really good for that.
Charlie, I won't ask if you miss the late lamented CBA, but do you miss basketball?
Let's see. Well, I certainly miss it now that there's no NBA season. I miss that. I miss playing, and I don't miss playing. I miss being 20 years old and playing, that's for sure. I don't miss playing in my later years. I played till I was 52, 53, when the only times that I was pain-free was when I was playing basketball. It did take me a while to feel comfortable not playing. But I also realized that I was never really talented, but I was big and strong, and I could shoot, and I could do a couple of things. I could set a great moving pick, terrific moving pick.
Which is, of course, illegal.
Of course. Not in the Bronx, though. Not where I grew up in the Bronx, it isn't. So I miss the camaraderie. I miss the freedom, the flow of the game. I miss that. And every time I heard a ball bounce for a couple of years, I kind of got a heart pang. But now I don't miss it at all.
Charlie Rosen is the author of lots of books having to do with basketball, the most recent of which is Crazy Basketball, A Life in and Out of Bounds, published by the University of Nebraska Press. He spoke with me from WAMC in Albany. Charlie, thank you very much for joining me.
Well, again, thank you very much for asking me to join you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.
Ah, the music swells, and on to the previously empty stage come the dancers, spinning and twirling, doing things of that nature. I can hardly wait to see them. But, oh, perhaps I'll have to wait, because, like the NFL football players and the NBA basketball players, the Joffrey Ballet dancers are facing a lockout. The ballet's contract with the American Guild of Musical Artists expired Thursday night, and the ballet company, fearing a strike, has told the dancers they should clear out their lockers. One assumes that they will do that with grace, of course, and that if the dancers ever do walk, it will be the most elegant strike in the history of organized labor.